think that in Christian community, it's a particularly important opportunity to talk about family, because we hear so much stuff about family in other ways, and through the public media, through a popular culture. And I think that it's very interesting to all of us, and important to talk about family when we're in Christian community, which isn't always the case for all of us. Our panelists this evening are Tim Hansen, who is the fire chief at Holden Village, Janet Grant, who is one of the directors at Holden Village, Carol Nolte, who is a pastor, an ELCA pastor in Los Angeles, and I just wrote Janet Grant's name down the front. Kata Schwain, I didn't write it down. Kata Schwain, who is on staff here this summer and who is a student at Gustavus Adolphus College. As they each talk about their family, their thoughts about family, it'll become apparent why they've been asked to be on the panel. My name is Ingrid Christiansen. I should tell you that I am a happily married person. My husband isn't here right now. His name is Jody Kretzman, but he's been here lots of other times. He loves Holden Village. We have two children, one of whom is here on staff as a Maverick this summer. And we view Holden Village as having been a great gift to our family through the years. The forum at Holden is really an opportunity for everyone to share their best thinking about whatever the topic is for the night. So it's an invitation to people to bring controversy into what can be a very vital and engaging, and I would say safe in some ways, space. By safe, I don't mean that we agree with one another. I think it's wonderful to bring different points of view. But I think that as people of faith, as people with serious convictions about how to live our lives, it is extremely important that we can bring those thoughts and ideas into this kind of a place and share them together. And we have to trust that in the melting pot or in the salad bowl of our ideas, that we will all be the better for having heard one another's thinking about whatever topic it is. Because we are anxious for all to be able to speak, we value every voice in the room, and of course that means that no one voice should dominate. All points of view are valued and respected, and I would say that it's a good to disagree with one another. It's an actual positive value. That goes a little against my illusion of faith. We try to be nice, but I think we can be nice and disagree with each other. So let's be open to that. One of the nice things about a forum is that we don't have to come to a decision. We air lots of points of view and welcome them all. We learn from them and are enriched by one another's thinking and honesty and good hearts. But we don't have to make a decision. We're not a committee, and we don't have a goal, except to hear each other out and think about it. We all were raised in families in one way or another. Now, I think even people who are raised in orphanages feel that there's some measure of family that they look back on and think about. And we all have notions about who we want around us as our life continues to give us support and love and all the things that one might expect from a family, some more of which we can list out here tonight. Families are changing in our society, and sometimes we think this is cause for grave concern. So there's a wonderful book that, until today, was in the bookstore, but too bad for you, I bought the last copy. So if you want to go and get it when you leave Holden Village, it's called The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap by Stephanie Kuntz. And since I bought it this morning, I really had my nose in it quite a bit because it's a fascinating book. And I thought it might be fun for you to hear just to kind of frame up the discussion, to hear a few points that she makes about the nature of family in America today. I basically wanted to learn from her, what are the numbers? You know, what are the statistics? And she, of course, is an academic person, and it's way too complicated to say simply what the statistics are. She does say at one point that, well, I'll tell you, let me, there are a few little places in here that I do want to quickly summarize for you. In her chapter, Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet, American Families in the 50s, she says that currently, this was written in 92, so it's a little bit out of date, but not terribly, fewer than 10% of American families meet the Ozzie and Harriet or Leave It to Beaver model. So she says that conservatives think that more than half of all mothers with preschool children are not employed or are employed part-time. And leave it, you know, the model is a woman staying at home and a man being in the workforce and there being children present. And she, fewer than 10% of us do that. One of the interesting things she points out is that, of course, those numbers are getting smaller and smaller, partly because we're an aging population. How many 75-year-olds do you know who still have their children at home? And those numbers are counted when you think about the numbers. So, I mean, there are 75-year-olds who do still have their children at home, but not
they're retired too.
So it's helpful, really, to get the statistics to come back.
Are there any statistics that you know of that would were from like the 50s that would
She does this. Read the book, Kevin.
Okay.
Really. Yes, is the answer. She says liberals seem to think that unless they can prove the Leave It to Beaver family is on an irreversible slide toward extinction, they cannot justify introducing new family definitions and social policies. Conservatives believe that if they can demonstrate that traditional family is alive and well, although endangered by policies that reward two-earner families and single parents, they can pass measures to revive the seeming placidity and prosperity of the 50s. So she says that's why people contend about these issues, and it has to do with public policy and money. That's what it comes down to, really, which is, I think, a valuable reminder. In her chapter on marriage, entitled, her chapters, First Comes Love, Then Comes Mary with a Baby Carriage, Marriage, Sex, and Reproduction. She says, she lists four things, marriage, sex, reproduction, and child rearing. And she says that those four things, marriage, sex, reproduction, and child rearing, are becoming uncoupled in our society. So that what used to be considered a package, although she then contests that it ever really was considered a package, and she goes into all sorts of historical data. She basically argues that the 50s were a pretty isolated decade and that nothing has ever been like them before or since. But we keep measuring ourselves against the 50s as though that was. So that's why the title of this form was Leave It to Beaver, had to do with Leave It to Beaver. But she says marriage, sex, reproduction, and child rearing provide, she says they're uncoupling. The average age for marriage has risen since 1950 by 6 years. So people are getting married older. More than three quarters of today's 18 to 24-year-old men and women have never married. And the majority of young adults today leave their parental homes and establish themselves in jobs well before marriage. Marriage is also less likely now, in the 90s, to last until death. About 50% of first marriages fail, and about 60% of second marriages fail and end in divorce. She says, as a result of both the rising age for marriage and the frequency of divorce, men and women spend, on average, more than half of their lives unmarried. So we're talking on this panel tonight about different models of family, but the fact that you're unmarried doesn't necessarily have to be coupled with your notions about family. It's something that I think we're discovering as we observe our experience and as life goes on. Men and women also live more of their lives alone, and then she goes on and talks about that. Then she says child rearing is no longer as tightly linked to marriage as in the past. Approximately 750,000 unmarried couples in America are raising children together. In 1990, a quarter of all new births were out of wedlock. In half of them, there was no identified father. since parenthood has ceased to inhibit divorce the way it did as late as 1970, more than half of American children will live in a single-parent household for some period of their childhood. Then she talks about sex. Sex is far more likely to occur outside marriage than at any time during recent history. By the mid-80s, 75% of American women were sexually active before marriage. Then she talks about the number of cohabiting couples that is enormous, and 80% increased in the last 20 years. The separation of sex, marriage, and child rearing is most dramatically demonstrated in the new legal and social definitions of family that have emerged over the last two decades. The law is changing about what family is. Many states and cities have adopted domestic partner laws allowing unmarried, heterosexual, or homosexual couples certain privileges that used to be accorded only to traditional married couples. It used to be that a couple of... In 1989, New York's highest court ruled that the surviving member of a gay couple held the same legal rights to the apartment they had shared as would a surviving wife or husband. And of course, you know that in New York, inheriting the apartment is a big deal. The relationship had been, and these are the qualities that she points to, the for a relationship, a non-married partnership relationship. Exclusive, long-lasting, committed, self-sacrificing, and public. Which is an interesting list. Maybe I should write them down. So I think with those comments, that's enough to hear out of this book. It's a fascinating book. I really do recommend it, The Way We Never Were. But that sort of frames up the discussion and makes us realize that it's important for us to think about these because I think these issues affect every one of us in a variety of ways and certainly affect people that we know and love. So I'm going to turn to our panel and we'll hear approximately 3 minutes from each of them and then we'll open it up to discussion. Carol, why don't you start?
Well, I have the Bible here. She asked me if I would try to give some background for biblical images of families. And that's like trying to pick a proper text for a wedding. You know, it's really hard. So I'd like to call upon you to help me with this. Name some famous couples in the Bible.
Sarah
and Abraham.
Mary and Joseph.
Mary and Joseph.
Ruth and Naomi.
Ruth and Naomi.
David and Jonathan.
Excuse me?
David and Jonathan.
David and Jonathan. Now name some famous single people.
Jesus.
Everybody else.
Everybody else. Maybe Paul. I mean, Paul.
Paul.
Can you name any widows?
Naomi.
Widow.
Yeah. Can you name any people who are not married but are living together?
That was the woman at the well.
David, Bathsheba.
Yeah. Okay.
Martin Luther and Katie.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Hold it, I was thinking of not married and living together like a family were Mary and Martha and Lazarus.
Oh, okay.
And so there's a whole bunch of names that kind of crop up. But when you say, but how did they manage it? How did they? Who organized? Who was the organ? What was the organizing factor? Did they live in a house or? How did they do it? You know, it isn't really here as far as I can see. There are a couple of things that came to my mind as I thought about biblical ideas about marriage, and the most interesting one still to me is that there's quotation about when you're interested in getting married for the male. It is said, let a man leave his father and mother and cling to his wife. And that's always almost the exact opposite of what we think about independence. So that's an interesting little problematic thing. And then, like, yeah. And well, I think maybe that's, and that's usually in the context of divorce that there, that that injunction is talked about. But also there's something there that may have to do with loyalties to first families. And then there are several things that have to do with making sure that your children are are nourished or instructed, and raising them up in the way that they should go, so that there's discipline, but there's also love. And other than that, I think there isn't very much here, so that you begin to understand how cultural and our marriages are, and family structures are. And that's why, I mean, I just sort of have a real difficult time whenever the church decides to make a pronouncement about this is the way it should be, because for who and for what age and all of that. So I would encourage us to really be creative in thinking about how this gets talked about. Oh, I just recently did a Noah's Ark thing, and I thought it was interesting that all the animals, everybody on the ark, came off it in families. And that's an interesting thought. They sort of group together and tromp off together. That's good. And other than that, I mean, I think that almost anything is worth looking at. Oh, I have one last thing. There's a whole bunch of stuff in Scripture about childless couples and how terrible that is, especially for the woman. And I'll simply say that in my parish, I still have a woman who was 86. She was a widow when I got to this parish. And the first time that the Sarah and Abraham text came around, and I read that, Borghild came up to me after the service with her Norwegian accent and said, "Just give me an Abraham and I'll try." So she still longed for a family.
She probably didn't say that.
Thank you. Thank you. That's very helpful. I mean, we sort of have these assumptions that the 50s notion of family was handed down from the Bible, and it's good for us to sort of revisit that notion. Janet, why don't you go next?
Okay. My name is Janet Grant. I'm 45 years old. I've always been single. I have two parents who have been married almost 62 years. A sister, two brothers who are all married, 10 nieces and nephews, and 10 grand nieces and nephews. I'm the youngest. I have not lived within 130 miles of those people for more than half my life, but I'm very close to them in different ways. Just figured that out, that more than half my life, I had to do a little subtraction up here. That I haven't, and most of that time I've lived 250 miles or 2,000 miles away from those people. I have, though, for the last 16 years, been a part of a community of one shape or another that probably serves more as intimacy for me than that blood family does, even though I'm very close to them. I was part of a community in Minneapolis for a number of years, called the Community of St. Martin, which is a worshiping community. And I've been part of this community in the last 16 years, 6 years, living here. I've chosen to do those sorts of things partly because the opportunity came before me to be able to choose those sorts of things. And my life made it possible for me to choose those sorts of things. I didn't have encumbrances that kept me from being able to move to Washington State and in a remote mountain village that kept me from doing that. So I have chosen to be more intimately involved with a group of probably 60 people in the wintertime living here, where we share meals, we share a worship life, we share the work of this place, we share the scarcity of this place in the winter, meaning the sense of scarcity of electricity, light, those sorts of things. We share the abundance of this place, meaning one another and time together and snow. There's an abundance of that. So, one of the things that the last 3 years that gives me lots of energy in this place is our boarding school program. I administer that here. And I find myself kind of, if I don't want to do something else, I'll always kind of turn to fussing with that little program. And I get a lot of energy from it. And what is part of that program has been inviting high schoolers to come and live in this place and go to school here. And they come, live here, are resident, and their work here is being students in our school. And part of their being here is an agreement to live with an adult in the community who serves as their sponsor. And I have had the privilege of doing that for 2 10-month blocks of time in the last 2 years. Two young women have lived with me, one junior during her junior year, one during her senior year. That has been a real gift to me, a source of joy, in the sense that I'm able to invite into my home and into my life a young person who is on the edge of adulthood. So it's been a real gift to me to be able to parent in that way. But I'm pretty strict with myself about not calling myself a surrogate parent to those people. I'm a better aunt, I think. But I serve as a friend to them, and they to me. So I have been able to share some of my nurturing, gift of nurture, and to have the joy of a young person in my life and in my home, and to share the struggles and joys of those people's lives. That's been a real gift to me. So I guess to come into a community like this, for me, well, choosing to do that sponsorship, someone was talking to me today about that and saying, are you going to do it next year? And I said, I hadn't made a final decision about that, but I certainly have thought about doing that for another year, largely because it's kind of my chance to have, I'm probably going to live here 5 years, maybe longer. This is my chance to kind of have a young person live in my home and live with me. So I don't want to miss that opportunity. This is what I've said about that. A couple of years ago, when I had the first chance to do it, I thought, what are you doing? You're the director of Olden Village. You have enough stresses on you. And you're bringing a teenager into your home? And you've not lived with children before? In my adult life. But it turned out to be one of the most heartwarming and best gifts I've ever given myself, and she gave me. So it was worth the risk, and I believe that it still will be. That's enough. That's probably 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So intentional community there, and intentional parenting or aunting of young people, selecting young people and relating to them in an intensive way, which is a gift that goes two ways, of course. The other person on the panel who is a long-term resident of Holden Village is Tim Hansen, the fire chief, and we'll ask Tim to go next.
Thanks. Tim Hansen, I'm 32. I want to give you a little bit of background about the family that I came from, and then talk a little bit about some of my ideas about family. I come from a large family. My mother and father were married for 27 years before divorcing. They had a total of 10 children, 6 surviving. I'm second to the youngest. All of my brothers and sisters are married. I have 18 nieces and nephews, 3 great nephews, it's called, with one on the way. All of my family lives within about 20 miles of one another, except for myself. We were raised in a small town, Lakeville, Minnesota, south of Minneapolis. Parents were mostly farmers and doing things with the land, I would say. So that's sort of the context in which I grew up. As a kid, I fantasized about what I thought my family was going to be like as I got older, and I imagined that I would get married and that I would have 3 children. And I named those children quite early on. My original names were Kevin Charles and Lisa Marie, and decided the other child would be a girl, but I would wait on her name and probably name her after one of my two sisters that died, but wanted to see which name fit. So I had this planned out pretty good. I'm a bit of a planner. But then things derailed a little bit as I entered into my teenage years, and the gift of sexuality began to be explored for me, and I discovered that I was gay. And suddenly, the plan that I had wasn't going to work out very well. I tried and hoped that it would work out, but that wasn't who I was. So, at that point, I didn't know much about what it meant to be gay, but I sort of followed some of the stereotypes, or looked at the stereotypes and what the media and jokes and people had to say about it. And what I knew then of the gay community was that there wasn't any such thing as families, and people weren't even couples. Everyone just sort of partied and slept around, I guess. And I knew that that wasn't who I was, and it wasn't who I wanted to be. And so my coming out process took many, 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 many years, and it wasn't until I was in my early 20s when I began to understand more about who I was, and that the choice of how I lived my life had lots of different options. I began to meet gay and lesbian folks that lived in long-term committed relationships, 10, 20, 30, 40, even though two guys that have been together over 50 years. So at first that shocked me, because I just never thought that that would be a possibility. So that invigorated me and excited me, because that fit into more of who I knew that I was in the life that I wanted to have. Then the question of children came along, and I love kids. I gravitate towards children, and I have a deep, deep desire to have children of my own. And I've discovered that gay and lesbian folks in committed relationships, and also as singles, do have children. You just have to be a little more creative and look at the different options that are available to having children. For a long time, I thought that I would probably adopt children. And then when my younger brother and my next older brother both got married and had children, something happened to me, and I just really felt that I wanted a child that was my own, that was of me. And that set me into a bit of a tailspin, trying to figure out how I wanted that to happen. And since, I guess women sometimes go through this point, don't they? Real birthing time, it's time, we gotta do this. The clock is ticking. Yeah, is that what it is? Well, and someone used that phrase last year, actually, or 2 years ago in the community, because that was where I was when I first came to Holden in 95. And a friend of mine said, Tim, you sound like you think there's a clock ticking inside of you or something. You know, relax and look at your options. And I realized that I had told myself that by the time I was 30, I was going to have a child. And I had just turned 30, so I realized that I did have a bit of a clock ticking. So I just reset that clock a little bit. The desire and the hope is still there. What I've learned, I think, about family is that I have a card up on my wall that says, friends are the family that we choose. And to me, my definition of family has really just sort of blown open into a lot of different dimensions. The friendships and the connections that I've made with people, both in my church and in the community, really touch me as family members. My blood family, my relatives, are sort of in a different category, of who I'm also very, very connected to, and I celebrate our relationship, but sometimes that's different. So I've learned to be open to the blessing of families and community, and also in with relatives. I'm excited now to move forward. I'm in relationship and to look at our future together, and to think about the possibility of children and how our future might unfold is really an exciting time for me. So a bit about family.
Thank you, Tim. I asked Kata to share her wisdom with us on this, as a young person who is, in my view, a very thoughtful person and in some ways an ideal young person, idealized or something. to hear one voice from someone who's still in college about just sort of what she imagines might be her future and family and where those ideas come from.
My parents got divorced when I was 2. When I was around 5 or 6, both of them remarried again. And as a result, through my entire childhood and up until now, I have had families in 2 separate cities. In Minneapolis, I live with my mom and my stepdad, 2 older stepbrothers who are now 22 and 24, I think, and a younger half-brother who's 11. In Valparaiso, Indiana, I live with my dad, my stepmom, and a younger, well, half-brother and sister who are both 11 years old, they're twins. And both of those families, except for my stepbrothers, are here right now. So that's a lot of fun, too. They all get along really, really well, which I'm really, really lucky for, because I know people whose families don't get along well. When Ingrid asked me to say something, I got really worried because everyone else kind of has this idea of where they want their families to go, but I have no idea at all. I think that I would like to find like a significant other somewhere down the road. I don't know if I would marry them, and I have no idea if I would have a family. And that kind of worried me then when she asked me to say something, but I realized that that's kind of an indication that my families have done a good job raising me, because I think that one of the mistakes my parents made was getting married too early, which, like, my mom was, it was after her sophomore year in college. And when I think about getting married after another year in college, I laugh really hard. And
that's good.
So yeah, so I think that's like a really good thing. A lot of my childhood, I think I spent blaming the problems that I had growing up on my parents being divorced, and assumed that all those, you know, problems that I had in junior high with guys or, you know, with whatever must somehow be connected to the fact that my parents were divorced, and kind of oblivious to the fact that maybe all other pre-adolescents were going through the same thing. I guess when I think about it, I had a really good best friend when I was growing up through most of my childhood. Her name was Sarah Mulligan, and she lived across the street from me, and she had the perfect family. I mean, you know, they were the nuclear family, and the dad, mom, and Sarah, and then she had a little brother who was like 4 years younger than her. They all like looked exactly the same, you know, like they looked like a postcard family or something. And I loved going over to their house because they had a beautiful house and like the perfect furniture, and like the parents didn't argue, there was no conflict, and like they had like my mom always cooked, you know, all this organic, good for you food. They had, you know, the sugar and everything like that. So I loved going over there and, you know, knew that this was like the perfect family, you know? I mean, they had it made. And a few years later, Sarah and I kind of went our separate ways for various reasons, but we ended up at the same high school. And my sophomore, junior year, we were both on a retreat together, and we were kind of reminiscing about childhood and all the things we used to do, and kind of, you know, we're getting a little teary-eyed, crying a little, just kind of remembering back. And I said to her, I was like, Sarah, you know, my whole life, I was so jealous of you. I'd love to go to your house because you had the perfect family. And she looked at me, and her mouth dropped open. She had this look of shock on her face, and she said, Kata, you always had the perfect family. And like, I was like, what, you know? As far as I knew, I had the most messed up family around, you know? And I think that's when I started looking at my family, not in terms of being divorced or whatever, but how I had been given unconditional love my entire life, and how my parents and my step-parents had given me everything I needed to be a successful kid. And so I worry when I look at having my own family, not so much about whether it works out perfectly, you know, or whether I have the nuclear family or the perfect house, but whether I would have the ability to give my kids the amount of love that my family has given me.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, There you have it. It was interesting when I looked around and thought about who should be on this panel, because I thought I naturally, in a panel of families, assumed that I would find idealized nuclear families in some sense, and then all the interesting voices that I wanted to hear from were all these interesting people that were not in idealized nuclear families, but making family and had in various interesting ways. So, of course, I should say that I think my husband is a perfectly lovely man.
And you're right, he is.
Yes, right. Dia?
I know, it's very nice.
So there is one person who's from a more that, I mean, I don't fit the stereotype either, because I work full-time, and my husband works full-time, and we're lucky if we see each other 3 nights a week, you know, so we have to create, those of us in that sort of situation, create life new, too, and are kind of figuring out how to do it as we go along, and making it up as we go along. But now it's your turn. What comments or questions or disagreements or agreements, or what would you like to say? What do you think is important to bring into this salad bowl of ideas?
I just first want to say what a pleasure it is to hear from all of you. I don't know, it just feels great to hearing all of your different experiences, and I don't know, it's hard to, it just feels really good to me, so I really appreciate all of your being willing to talk about your different experiences. And I also just want to see, what is your name?
Kata.
It just seems, but you know, at the end, when you go, your worry is that having been given such terrific unconditional love, can you, you know, turn around and pass that on? I thought if you had been given it, then you knew that you could. Because I felt like, you know, I mean, you know, there's some wonderful things about my family, but it was also very a difficult growing up. And so, I'm on the verge of probably maybe having children myself, and excited about it and terrified about it. And but I would, it's sort of that thing also about, oh, the perfect family somewhere else. It's sort of like I would assume that because you were given that you'd be really confident that you could pass it on, but no.
When I think about marriage or with a family, when I think about family, I think two or more people in a committed long-term relationship. And with the topic that you had, that name or whatever, I found it offensive, because still the majority of children in our schools come from families that are traditional. And the statistics are changing, we know, but it's still the majority. And I think sometimes we're looking at other models, or we're talking about the crisis of single parenting or blended families, but the majority is still mom and dad together. And I'm just trying to say that. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Are you sure that's true? I'm not even
sure. Yes, I'm very sure it's true, okay. Because my profession involves families. And like that statistic where she said that many states and cities are changing the laws, I disagree with that. And I disagree with it because Washington State, the last two legislative sessions, fought real hard to prohibit any sort of same-sex relationships. And it's the rare state that's adopted the policy. But the statistics on the majority of the family in America being husband and wife is still there. Is still there.
Do you have an opinion about that? Or you obviously feel strongly that we know that about the statistic, but I'm curious what your thoughts are about it.
Well, I think any type of family situation that's nonviolent and loving is fine with me. But I sometimes think we're trying to flush down the traditional family model. And I don't even know if it's traditional, because at the time of the Revolutionary War, 3 out of 4 women in New England that had children were unmarried. So in my lifetime, I'm familiar with mom and dad at home, and mom may be working or may not be. So I kind of like that model.
Okay.
Deanne is next, and then Carol.
Well, both my husband and I come from those kind of families. Our parents are both, you know, in both sets, both parents are still living, and they're still married to each other, and, you know, and we're still married to each other, and we have this one lovely little boy. So I suppose in some ways you'd think, my goodness, that's just perfect. But I can't imagine. I remember that about 3 weeks before our son was born, my good friend was staying with me for the weekend because Rick had to go out of town. And she asked me how I felt about having a child. And I said I was absolutely terrified. I was so afraid that I wouldn't know how to do this. And I said, you know, the only reason I'm not terrified beyond doing this is because I don't believe this child will belong to me. And the same thing happened when he was going to be baptized. We had the baptism at the early service, because, in part because we had to go dashing off to Kenosha where my husband was teaching, and it was hours away, and also because someone in our congregation who always went to the early service, who I absolutely adored, said, we never get any baptisms at the early service. Everybody wants to do it at the late service. Great. For Dick Evenson, I would do it. So, the godmother, this is a long story to make a small point. The godmother and godfather were there. And I hadn't seen this woman for months, of course. And so we stayed up really late, 11 o'clock. But it was, you know, it was really late at that point in my life. And we overslept in the morning. Oh, we got 8:30. Seriously, oh, we got about 7:45. Dashing out of that, I'm standing there in the shower thinking, I don't have time to wash my hair, I'm feeling terrible. And then I thought, what is this about? This isn't about how I look. This is about going to the front, handing my baby over to this other person, and letting her have the child baptized. So yeah, it looks like this little nuclear family, but I couldn't do it by myself. So I think it's really important to think about, you know, my brother lived with me when he was born, his godparents, the kids he knows at Holden, who he sees every summer, are my son's cousins, because although we look like this lovely little nuclear family, he's rich in uncles and has no cousins. So, I mean, when I hear you say that we're dumping on the traditional family, I think that the traditional family has its own limitations and needs and vulnerabilities, and that to talk about it in some isolated way really impoverishes what it means to be family. And I didn't think that getting married was a way of making my life smaller. I hoped it was a way to make my life bigger. Which,
that's an important point, I think. Thank you. Thanks, Deanne. Carol.
Oh, I was going to say that again, if you look at scripture for any kind of model there, it's very confusing because instead of a statistical chart that takes a fix at a given point and says everybody, this many people are married, and what the Bible also does is give you some stories of people, and at some point they may have been married and then they're not, or at some point they may have been single and then they get married. I mean, we don't know whether Paul was a widower or not, and if he's a widower, why, he may have or may not have had children, and now he's living as a single man. And at some point, we've got the Naomi and Ruth story, and their lives change radically. Husbands. I mean, I just think that in some ways, scripture is very liberating if you take the long view and say, gee, you know, there's not a whole lot there to tell us how it's all set up. It's just that it's very obvious that there are characters in every category. And then I guess I'd say that the only thing that sort of continuation of rules to do with that, not structures, but it seems to me that if you look at the second table of the commandments, you get some sense about how to relate to each other, but that's legalistic. So that but the honoring parents is one thing, and and honoring the fidelity, keeping fidelity within the marriage is important. And then there are some rules about when that breaks up, you know. So I think it's really neat. It gives us a lot of freedom to say what's going to work for us in this day and age with this economy, and given all the things that we have in our society to put us in a different position than New Testament or Old Testament or any place along the way.
Thank you. Tim is next.
I'm thinking as I'm listening to this, there are a lot of different relationships that are important to make a whole person. And there are a bunch of pieces of these relationships that have the potential to be fulfilled in a nuclear family, in a traditional nuclear family. Mm-hmm. You've got an older male role model, an older female role model, and you've got kids around, and you've got adults around, and you've got siblings, all these different relationships that interplay with each other, and that are real important in building up a whole person, not just the whole child, but also the whole adult. But even in that Cleaver family, there's still pieces missing, because where's grandma and grandpa? You know, where are the older people who would add immense richness to this situation? That's a whole piece that we've lost. And even if you have those together, you know, there are all these other kinds of relationships that need to be around for a person to be really whole. So even if you have that, like I grew up in a Cleaver family, essentially, without the extended family, and I missed that. And without living in communities that had some of these other relationships to offer me. Now, if my mom hadn't been around, I would have had needs for for an older woman in my life, giving me some of the things that I got from my mother. If my siblings hadn't been around, I would have needed that. And so even being in a nuclear family, I still had need for other relationships from the community. And now that moved away from home, I have one partner that I live with, and I get some things from her, but I'm missing, you know, I'm missing those little feet, and I'm missing the teenagers, and I'm missing the old people, I'm missing all of these pieces, and I think what I need to do is get those from the community. So what's occurring to me is that we can't expect the family unit to supply all of the rich relationships that we need, and whatever any of us as an individual happens to have around us in terms of a family unit, we're going to need to supplement that with the community. Even if you have a traditional nuclear family and you've got extended family around, you still need to supplement that with the community. If you're an individual, you need to supplement it even more. If you're two people of the same gender together, you need to supplement that. If you're two people of different genders, you need to supplement that. So we all need to look at our family relationship, get what we can out of that, and supplement it with these relationships elsewhere, and make those so much richer than it's easy to make them, given North America in 1997.
Thank you. Did I see a hand there?
What I was... If we're really thinking in a sense of a Christ-centered community, it's interesting to think of that Jesus never had Joseph as the legitimate biological father. So basically Joseph was the stepfather for Jesus. And stepbrothers can be argued. So if we're really trying to talk about what's a traditional model for family, I don't think we can be supported. We can only come up with our own perceptions. And it's also interesting, if you ever think about it, I don't think Jesus ever talked about family. He always talked about neighbor and community, but he never talked about family. And even when he did talk about family, he dismissed it and said, they're all my brothers and sisters, or that. So it troubles me to sense that sometimes we try to limit our perceptions or views of what family is by a defined period of time, if you want to call it the Beaver time or whatever time you want to call it. But I think what I would say in a Christ-centered community, I think we're called to expand and to broaden our scope of what community is, and then how does that help us, live as who we are called to be, and that's children of God, and that's in relationship, And that's going to be defined in all different ways. And that's tough because we want to have, it's like we want to limit God, we want to limit our families too. And it'd be better if we can open ourselves up to a sense of what could it be.
I wonder about models of intentional community. How many of you have lived, how many have lived in some kind of intentional community inside or in addition to a nuclear family? Lots of
people from all of them.
I wonder, Janet, whether you'd tell us a couple of the characteristics of the community in Minneapolis that we might think about. For example, the cars or the some things about.
Kate is also a part of that community. One of the things that she wants me to tell you about. when I lived in Minneapolis in the community of St. Martin, I shared, I owned two cars, but I owned them with three other people. So four of us owned two cars together. We lived within two blocks of each other, and we shared a lot of life together. We were part of the same worshiping community. Many of us worked in the same place. So we had a lot of common life together. So sharing a car wasn't that difficult. In fact, it was easier. Because I hate maintenance, but I didn't mind reading books. So we shared our gifts and our interests in that way, and I didn't have to make all the decisions of when we went to buy a new car. I could get some advice from three other people, and that sort of thing. Some of those same people now I have gone in with and then bought some property together in Chelan. So we live all over the country. So, I want to say something about that, the community of Ricky, and the characteristics of it. I think that the main part for me of that community and this community is that it is centered in worship, our life together. We come together, and that is the common place that we have together. We share scripture, we pray, we sing. We try to forgive one another, work at it. So that really is the key piece for me.
Jackie.
Well, I appreciate calling attention to the cultural sort of definition of family. And earlier this summer, we were gifted with the presence of an Episcopalian priest and nun, Sister Rosina Ampa, who comes originally from Ghana but has lived in the States for the last 18 years. And we did a forum similarly to this, only she really enlightened us a little bit about the perhaps overuse of the phrase, it takes a village to raise a child, and said that we were actually, it was incomplete how we were using it, and that in Ghana it really begins with when the baby is in the womb, it belongs to the mother, but when the baby is born, it takes a village to raise a child. And she was very good at pointing out to us how in America we care about children, but we generally just care about our own children. And that we become quite protective of this sort of grouping. And she said that's not the experience in Ghana and perhaps many other countries in the world where there's a sense that children really do belong to all of us. And we care about children more than just beyond our own procreation. So
it's one of the things I would have added to my what I said about hosting some teens, that there were other parents that shared those young people with me and with this community, that released those children to spend a year here in this community, trusting us.
I taught for 19 years in Shelton, Washington, and we had a large Native American population in our school, and their idea of family, when a child was absent, they would have to bring a note saying why they were absent, and oftentimes it was not signed by the same person, but and then you question them, well, that's Uncle Jim or whoever, and Mom and Dad are out fishing this week, and so all of those are family, and they have that sense of community. Raises the family. And it's a beautiful thing. They take responsibility for each other.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. This is primarily people of European descent would be having this conversation, and most of the other community of groups of people in the world. Wouldn't be having this conversation about what's family and be thinking of family in terms of mom, dad, and two kids. They wouldn't. It just would be a dissonance to be thinking of that smaller group as a family. Even to the point of, you know, the strict, close biological relationships. It's, you know, we all live together, we're all family, and the use of aunt and uncle and brother and sister and cousin in other languages, and even in North America, you know, in the African American community, Native American, Hispanic, just a whole different scene. And I guess it's very frustrating to me to find myself stuck in this way of thinking about balance. I have a hard time getting out of it, and I go to my house in the suburbs, and there I am, I'm inside. You know, go to other neighborhoods, and the whole neighborhood is, not to idealize the whole neighborhood is family, but there's a whole lot more connection going on.
Why do you think that happened?
What?
That the European version, the quote, American version of family is the mom, pop, and two kids, and my kids, and nobody else's kids.
There are lots of books that have been written on that subject, of course, and one of the interesting takes on it that I saw a couple of years ago was written by an architect who talked about the physical plant that we tend to live in as people has changed. Homes no longer have porches. The architects no longer have homes with front porches. And people don't hang out on the front porch, and so the neighbors don't walk up and down the street and visit and take each other's children seriously and each other's problems seriously on some level because they know about them. Instead, we have interior spaces that are TV spaces family rooms, and then backyards, which are more isolated and private. But then there are all sorts of other, I mean, obviously there are millions of reasons why, to do with the way people make their money and the schedules that we're on. I live in a sixth flat in Chicago that's owned by three families. A sixth flat is six apartments, owned by three families. We've lived in it for more than 20 years, and while we bought it the day our first child was born, put the bid in the day before, but the bid was accepted. When we called home from the hospital to say, we have a girl, they said, by the way, we have a building on the house too. But we always have had friends living in the sixth flat, which of course is completely what you're advised not to do. But it works so well that we can't think why we should follow the advice. And we always have friends with some of the people living in the building have similar age children to ours, which has always meant that there have been lots of playmates and up and down the stairs. And, you know, even though we live on one floor, the kids could learn to climb stairs because everybody in the building is a friend. And one time when I had a child with anaphylactic shock to a bee sting, I stood on the front, ran out of the stairwell and holding a baby, and the child said, help, you know, really loud. And I got help right away. And, you know, it's so wonderful to have that kind of a living situation. And we have building potlucks and barbecues, but we're not a worshiping community together, which I really miss. We garden together. But that's one little tiny way of kind of making, I think of it as recreating the corner of 10th Street and 10th Avenue in Morehead, Minnesota, which is where I was raised. My parents, a young couple moving to teach at Concordia, my father was chair of the music department. The chair of the music department, art department, chemistry department, math department, and religion department bought a big field with a stream running through it and divided it up into odd-shaped lots and hired contractors and started building houses and started having babies. And so I grew up with that community of kids, the running kids and the yellow soccer kids are some of my best friends to this day because they were all in that same communal backyard with a stream. I think my parents must have been crazy to let us play in that water, but they did, and none of us drowned. So, you know, I grew up with a model of some sense of communal living. I mean, whose house we ate at sort of depended on where we were in the day. When I was a kid, and this was 50 years ago, and it seemed pretty normal and healthy and regular for us to live that way, but it was sort of communal in some ways.
I have a funny story that this winter, the younger children around here, I think they get used to having a bunch of adults around that'll tell them, well, be careful, or don't do that, or here, come, let me help you. And, or they'll just pick the adult they want whose lap they want to crawl in during Vespers or whatever. And there was a young family here in January, just here for a month, and they had a small child who was about 3. And she was doing something in the dining hall that to me looked a little bit dangerous. So I went over to her and I said, don't do that, do it this way. And she took off to her mother, like, what is this person telling me what to do? Mm-hmm. And where other kids would just say, oh, okay, you know. But she didn't mm-hmm. quite get it, that there were other adults that would tell her what to do. Mm-hmm. And I think we get used to kind of like watching out for kids. And mm-hmm.
Well, then not just with children. I mean, I think one of the barriers to community is this idea of interfering in each other's lives. You know, yeah. The way you would to your brother, say, you're acting like a crazy person, stop it. But can you do that to someone that you're not blood related to?
Really?
Well, I'll get to what you're talking about, our family's kind of on a new little journey now, too, because we've just taken in a foster child. We've sort of taken in kids before, but this is, it's just a kind of redefining of, kind of who we are, if I'm mommy or if I'm Ricky, or who I am in relationship to this child who has another mother, you know, and it's not a stepmother. And so it's just a kind of a new, it's just a new little journey. But I'm also very grateful. She's new with us, and I was very excited for her to be able to bring her here because this child needs a village. She, you know, desperately needs all the things she can get. I wasn't aware of the theme, but we've been reading about, she tends to hang on everybody. She doesn't have clear boundaries. And so we read the Berenstain Bears, learn about strangers, and we don't touch everybody. Before we came up here, I made it very clear. I said, when you get to Holden, I said, there are no strangers. And the amount that this child has grown and blossomed and flourished in community is staggering.
You're going to have the last comment because we're over time, but this is such an interesting discussion.
Answer the question of the male member of the panel. I didn't remember Tim. His name. Yeah. His question was, why the breakdown of this community village concept? And my theory or answer to that would be is that there are many communities that we are involved in. In industrial North America, there is the proximity or the neighborhood community, there's the work community, there's the worship community, and there are probably others. And in this society, those communities are generally different, whereas in Uganda or Native America, etc., those communities generally were all the same groups of people. And I think as they have been separated, we have to work harder to bring them together and make them work.
Maybe that concept just won't make as good of a series as Leave It to Beaver. Leave It to Beaver. Leave It to Beaver's Neighborhood.
I know that we've gone a few minutes over, but I'm surprised, I have to say, at how little reaction there has been to Tim's comments. Gay man in a partnership longing for children and talking about adopting them. Is this something that is not controversial in this group, or is this someone that everyone's avoiding talking about?
I would ask for a show of hands of people in this room who are very familiar with relationships exactly like that that are working well. Because I, you know.
Okay, and that answers that question.
Become more public, I think. It's I can't imagine, a teenage boy, who's discovering that he's gay, that hasn't, that hasn't had some sort of exposure about gays and lesbians, and I'm glad that there's been so much about the gay marriage or the same-sex marriage, because it gives the signal, this happens. You know, I wish I would have heard that when I was 10, 11, 12. Whoa, great. You know, people make life commitments to one another. That's exactly what I want. That makes sense. So I think that, some of the controversy in the media and all that is educational in a sense, hopefully in a positive way.
I think what we're hearing tonight is that we all are living in a state of grace, that God is good, that there are many different wonderful ways that we can live together as people and care for one another deeply and feel secure and have our needs met and be in community together and be responsible to our world. So I really thank our panelists and also for all the people around the table tonight in this space, because you've all made wonderful contributions and I've learned a great deal, and I appreciate what everyone has had to say. So thanks so much.